Tactopia. Tactopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Ugeavisen Ingeniøren, med støtte fra Industriens Fond, Messecenter Herning, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tactopia. Når jeg høvler rundt i verden med Tactopia, så møder jeg ofte mennesker, som tænker anderledes og vilde tanker. Og nogle gange tænker man, ja okay, det er godt med dig. Og andre gange så tænker man, ja måske er der lige et eller andet, vi godt kan hive fat i her. En af dem, som jeg faktisk synes var meget sjovt at tale med, var svenskeren Askan Fader, som jeg mødte for et par år siden på Automatikmessen i Brøndbyhallen. Og grunden til, at jeg hiver ham op på skuffen her i sommerperioden, ja, det er jo fordi, at der snart er Automatikmesse igen, hvor man igen kan møde spændende mennesker her i starten af september. Jeg vender lige tilbage med datoerne her efter interviewet med Askan Fader.
The theory of what drives human beings, it's a theory that was developed by an anthropologist named Ernest Becker. He did this in the 70s, and it's derived from a lot of psychoanalytic work. So briefly, it deals with the dilemma that Ernest Becker proposes that we have, that we are partly biological animals, you know, we're biologically evolved to avoid death at all costs, but at the same time, we are self-conscious and self-aware, and we are intelligent enough to know that we are going to die anyway. So then the question is, how do we function despite this dilemma? That we are biologically evolved to avoid death, with instincts constantly reminding us to avoid death, but we know we're going to die anyway. And the idea is that the solution to this conflict is, of course, to deny death completely. And the best way to deny death is to become a superhero, an immortal superhero. So basically, the idea is that we seek for immortality, or at least the illusion of immortality. And again, this is, I would say, a philosophical model that I use to try to frame the human being and what drives the human being in this modern day and age. But what I've added to this is, how does the internet change the characteristic of how we choose to immortalize ourselves? So that's my starting point in my talks. My name is Askan Fardost, and I do a bunch of different things. Right now, I'm running a newly started investment firm called Oddball Ventures, where we invest in Swedish tech startup companies. And I work for Hyper Island. It's a school that was founded in Sweden that is now available in many parts of the world. And I'm writing my first book that's going to be called Termite Man.
And how does the internet support this then?
Well, historically, you know, if you look at a population of human beings, there's usually only a minority of this population that have the ability to create their own immortality projects. And that's the person we call, you know, the visionary entrepreneur, for example. If you take Tesla, the car company, as an example, there you have a very charismatic visionary, Elon Musk, who have created this immortality project of freeing mankind from the dependence on fossil fuels. So that's one way for Elon Musk to become an immortal superhero, right? But he's also good at inviting other people to be part of his immortality project. Again, that's why he's a visionary entrepreneur. So, but there's usually only a minority of a population that has this ability. Most people join somebody else's immortality project. And historically, to keep societies working together towards a grander goal, whatever that is, there's always been these political entrepreneurs that have conjured up these stories of what the meaning of life is. Let's say in Sweden, where I come from, for the last 100 years, the meaning of life has been work really hard and pay tax to the government. If you do that, you will get a Volvo, a house, and a dog at the end, and a pension so you can die in peace. And in Sweden, it's called the folkhemmet, you know, this huge house where everyone is a family. That has been kind of been the immortality project, the national ideal of Sweden, which most people have joined because you really didn't have much choice. Whereas with the internet, we have now 3 billion people and counting sitting in the same room where anyone can invent whatever story they want and distribute it to the rest of mankind, which means that everyone can now compete on creating alternative immortality projects, which I think will start to fragment this grand national ideals or grand immortality projects that we have had with us historically.
So what does this do to society and to nation states if we all become sort of small immortality tribes on the internet?
I think it will fragment the whole concept of the nation state. And I would say that's one way to explain what we're seeing in Europe right now, for example, in many democracies. You know, people aren't cohesive working together as they used to. It's much more fragmented, and it's easier to fragment. It's easier to challenge the establishment, and it's easier to gather people around you who believe the same. So I think this is going to eventually result in just a fragmented world with a lot of tribes around different ideas, for better and for worse. I mean, I still assume that most people are good people. But of course, you can use this new world order mechanic of the internet to do destructive things as well. Take the Islamic State, for example. Without the internet, they would have never been able to grow and recruit people as they did and cause all the damage that they did. So it's always for better and for worse.
But now you're here at a machinery, so to speak, conference. And they're talking about digital products and how this will affect their line of business. So how do you bring this into business?
So if you look at human society or human civilization, I would say civilization is a phenomenon from the last 8,000 to 12,000 years, when we switched from being hunter-gatherers to becoming agriculturalists. Because with that, we could produce a surplus of food. And when you have surplus of food, all people in a population don't have to spend their time looking for food, which means now you have more time available for other things, like creating more advanced cultures and inventing things at a much higher scale and rate and so on. So without surplus of food, you don't have civilization. Turns out, though, we aren't the only species that have shifted from hunting-gathering into agriculture. You have a lot of species of ants and termites, for example, that have done the same thing. So there is, I think, reason to believe that this shift isn't just some fluke of human ingenuity, but rather a very bioeconomic shift, that you can grow the population much more effectively if you become an agriculturalist. So in one sense, you could maybe play with the idea that we are biologically wired to be surplus seekers. We seek for surplus. Maybe not on an individual level, because you still have individuals who claim, oh, I don't want a surplus, I just want my little cottage and a nice house, I don't care about growth. But as a collective superorganism, we seek for surplus. Thing is, though, we effectivized agriculture to such an extent that instead of the majority of human beings being peasants, we don't need the majority of human beings being peasants anymore. I mean, now it's a minority of human beings doing all the agricultural work. So instead, with the Industrial Revolution, slowly but surely people started moving from the field to the factory instead. But what I'm seeing now is that we are effectivizing the factory as well, just as we effectivized agriculture. So if you say a lot of people have been dependent on factory jobs, on industrialist jobs for the last couple of 100 years, I think we're going to see the same shift where we have to move people out from the factory somewhere else. And we're going to effectivize that as well. Because, you know, we were agriculturalist surplus producers, then we effectivized the agriculture part, then we became materialist surplus producers, and now we are effectivizing that part. The question is, what's the next level of surplus going to be? So what the automation industry, so to say, is doing is effectively making this shift possible. But I think with that shift comes a responsibility, because this idea that most people have a secure employment and a pension and all these things, that's actually the anomaly in history. It's a very rare thing, and we've only had it for a very short time. So I am really unsure what's going to happen when in, say, 50 or 100 years from now, or maybe even faster, some claim faster, the majority of people can't be employed in the industrial machinery. So I think there is responsibility in being part of that shift making happening. What do we do with the humans that won't have a place here anymore?
And what is your answer to this? What do we do with these humans?
I don't have an answer that I think this is the solution. But if we again look at it from this grand perspective, we're agriculturalist surplus producers of food, effectivized that, then we became materialist surplus producers of, you know, material and the resources that come with it. And the next step is a question mark for me. Some argue that it's, you know, maybe it's data. Whoever owns the data owns the world, and so on. Could be. But I think regardless of what this question mark is, I think the best way we can prepare people is to help them be able to operate in this global digital tribal environment that the internet has created. And I think to do that, we have to start shifting the focus in schools a little bit, so that we train people to be very good communicators, because you have to be able to communicate your ideas and desires and what you want and how you want to build things, how you want to realize things, because otherwise you won't be able to function in a group. So we need to prepare our kids to be really good communicators, much better at collaborating, instead of this individualist idea that I'm going to get the best grades and I'm going to get the best job. Yeah, fine, but you still need to be able to cooperate in a group. Otherwise, you're done. I don't think you can survive in the global digital tribal environment if you can't collaborate with people. And also critical thinking, because now everyone can produce and distribute information. How can you deduce, is this good, valid information? Is this not valid information? I think these three things are important. And with these three things, I think hopefully you will become more creative. And when you're creative, I think you have the best shot of operating in this new environment.
You also mentioned the difference you see between digitization and digitalization. What is the difference between these two terms?
Well, I mean, this is just, I just separated these two terms purely arbitrarily, just to make the point that, you know, a lot of the talk around innovation and being creative in your company and doing futuristic things, for the last 20 or at least 10 years, it's really been, you know, make an app around whatever you were doing previously, or add a touchscreen to it. Now it's very innovative. And it's been just this pure, sterile process of just slapping on technology on all of your problems. So that's why I just made this arbitrary separation and said, okay, let's call this digitization, and then let's call this other thing digitalization. And this other thing that I call digitalization is when you're not only focusing on the technical aspects of things, but you're also incorporating into your worldview how digital technologies and the internet changes our behaviors and creates new expectations. Because if you don't take the behavioral part and the expectations part into account, I don't think you will be able to create something of value for people.
Do you have any examples of companies who are doing this in a good manner?
Yeah, I mean, one recent example is Volvo, in my opinion, Volvo Cars. And I love this example because a lot of people ask, you know, is it possible for old big companies to even, you know, make the shift? And yes, of course it is. And I think Volvo Cars is a great example of this. They are looking at, you know, the behavioral patterns of people, how people see mobility. They don't even call themselves a car company in the same sense anymore. They call themselves a mobility company, right? So they say, okay, what's mobility to people? That's going from point A to point B. Okay, do you need to own a car for that? Obviously, the answer for that is no. You don't need to own a car to go from point A to point B. So now they're, for example, experimenting with a subscription model for cars. You don't buy the car. You don't lease the car. You subscribe to it. You pay a fixed monthly fee. And when you're done with the car, you just return it immediately. like no 2-year advance deals, nothing like that. So that's what they started experimenting with. And now, based on the data they got from those experiments, I assume, they are going to launch a new app called M, stands for mobility. And with this app, you can do all of your mobility needs. You know, subscribe to a car for a month if you need that, lease a car or buy your car, and so on and so forth. So they are, you know, slowly but surely shifting their whole business model to align with the new behavioral patterns and the new expectations that have arisen because of the internet, among other things.
So instead of producing metal boxes on wheels, they have become a service company.
You could say that, yeah. I mean, they still produce the metal box with wheels, very beautiful metal box with wheels, I would say. But yes, they do that. But how the transaction happens is completely different now.
Do you have sort of like 3 pieces of advice for company leaders who wants to sort of survive in this new tribalism age?
I'm not really good at like 3 tips, 5 tips, but I mean, general advice is whatever you do, you have to be a tribal leader, right? If you look at all the companies that are doing well right now in the internet era, I would say one thing that most of them have in common is that they don't wait for change or behavior change to happen and then adjust to it. They push for behavior change. They see a possibility, then they believe in that possibility, then they push for it, which creates a new behavioral change. And in doing so, they also, of course, have to solve a very important problem for a group of people. And when you do that, you kind of become the tribal leader for that space, which means when you become a tribal leader, now you have loyal followers that truly believe in what you're doing because you're solving a very important problem for them. And then they can grow bottom up instead from top down. So, I mean, let's say Tesla, for example. Tesla pushed for the behavior change of making electric cars cool. All of a sudden, it became cool to own an electric car. Owning an electric car didn't mean you had to compromise with a bunch of stuff, you know. The car was faster and it had the same range as regular cars and so on. So they pushed for that behavior change, and that's how they became tribal leaders of that space. Because if you look at Tesla, it's structured as a tribe. It has a deep underlying cause of freeing mankind from fossil fuels. And then you have Elon Musk guarding this vision around the tribe, and all the employees and the customers are part of this tribe as well. Because, you know, when you drive a Tesla car, you're not only driving a high-tech luxury car, you're also saving the planet 1 mile at a time. You're almost part of a religion in a sense.
But could you say that Elon Musk and Tesla, they're the tribe of electric cars, but you have a lot of electric car producers, but they don't have these sort of tribal leader kind of leaders in top of their company. I mean, Volvo also has electric cars, so you could actually become part of a tribe, even though the tribal leader belongs to another company, or is that to take it too far?
Sure, I think that's possible. I mean, I consider myself part of the Tesla tribe. I don't own a Tesla, but I talk about Tesla everywhere I go because I love what they're doing so much. So yeah, I would say you could do that. But I think it's hard to maintain loyalty if you're not the tribal leader. You know, yes, every manufacturer may spit out an electric car, you know, eventually. So many of them are investing heavily in that. But I think you won't get the same loyalty. I mean, if you look at a lot of Tesla customers, they see the car online and they pay for it cash with their credit card before even having seen the actual product. That's completely new in, you know, car purchase behavior. So I don't think you can get the same level of loyalty unless you're a tribal leader. But Volvo, I think Volvo is such a strong and established brand, which is such a long history. So I think they don't necessarily need a person on the front lines, just like Elon Musk. I don't think you necessarily need that if the brand is strong enough. But that remains to be seen.
But isn't there a danger in these tribes? Because if you look at some of the really strong tribes, Facebook, Google, Apple, for instance, they tend to dominate totally.
Well, I wouldn't consider Facebook and Google as tribes. I mean, they are infrastructure companies. Facebook is the new social infrastructure. It's the new square, the city square. And I see Google as the new, you know, it's a data infrastructure of the world. So I don't consider them as tribes. I mean, if you want to analyze them, I would analyze them as, you know, are they monopolies or not?
But Apple will be a tribe.
Apple would more so be a tribe. I mean, you could argue that Google is a tribe because a lot of people love what Google does and what they stand for. But, you know, you could also argue that they don't stand for what they claim anymore. I mean, what was their tagline? Don't be evil. I think it's pretty hard to argue for that these days. But yes, Apple, yeah, they clearly stand for something. They are always in their own niche. They always push for behavior change. They basically dictate how people see consumer electronics. So they always set the standard for that. And a lot of Apple customers are religious followers of Apple, me included. So yeah, Apple I would still consider. Well, I mean, just because Facebook and Google aren't tribes necessarily from this viewpoint of mine, I would say still, yes, it's a very interesting debate and discussion we must have. Because now, again, Facebook is the new world square where people gather and talk about what they think and discuss politics and so on. So should that be a monopoly? Will they even survive being this kind of monopoly? Or should they have the right to censor things from their platform? You know, you can argue that they're a private company, they can do whatever they want. And yes, I buy that argument. But at the same time, you have the dilemma that they are the new world square. Should they be able to filter opinions? So yes, these are discussions definitely worth having, even though they are not tribes in that sense.
But as companies, shouldn't they be organized as tribes?
If you take Facebook, for example, they don't need to in the same sense because they don't have any competition. They don't have any competition, but they do extremely, you know, they are at the frontier, technologically speaking. So I think that that's one of the reasons they can attract a lot of good talent. I don't think they are not niched anymore in any sense, but they don't have any competition. So they basically don't need to. Apple, on the other hand, has a lot of competition. So maybe that's one thing that creates this distinction.
Ja, og det sagde altså den svenske teknologitænker og investor og startup mand Askon Fardost, som jeg havde mødt på automatikmessen i Brøndbyhallen. Og igen i år er der faktisk automatikmesse, den finder sted den 8. til 10. september, også i Brøndbyhallen. Og der kommer det til at blandt andet handle om Danmarks robotstrategi, det kommer til at handle om robotter i produktionen, og om kunstig intelligens og de 17 verdensmål fra FN. Og så bliver der også kigget på virtual reality, augmented reality og andre digitale hjælpemidler under hatten, digital reality, som altså handler om, hvordan man kan implementere nogle af de her teknologier i sin produktion, hvis man har en virksomhed. Du har lyttet til Techtopia. Her i sommerperioden udkommer vi hver 14. dag. Du kan finde links på techtopia.dk. Du kan følge podcasten på Twitter på @techtopia.dk. Du kan deltage i debatten på vores Facebook-gruppe, der hedder Techtopia Backstage. Og så kan du skrive til mig på henrik@techtopia.dk. Det var, hvad vi havde på tapetet den her uge. På genhør i næste uge. Techtopia. Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Ugeavisen Ingeniøren, med støtte fra Industriens Fond, Messecenter Herning, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia. Techtopia.